Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with returning guest Dr. Paul Dobransky about using something called observing ego. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. SWAT team raids home over hydroponic equipment purchase. And what do they find? Tomatoes and squash. Did you know that buying hydroponic growing equipment is now being used as a probable cause for the government to raid your house? Neither did Bob and Addie Hart, a Kansas couple who were raided by a SWAT team without a warrant last April because the authorities took notice of their purchase of indoor gardening items. The illegal raid turned up, quote, just six plants, three tomato plants, one melon plant, and two butternut squash plants growing in the basement. And now the couple is suing the sheriff's department. In another story, the AP reported two former CIA employees whose Kansas home was fruitlessly searched for marijuana during a two-state drug sweep claim they were illegally targeted because they had bought indoor growing supplies to raise vegetables. Adlin and Robert Hart sued this week to get more information about why sheriff's deputies searched their home in the upscale Kansas City suburb of Leawood last April as part of Operation Constant Gardener. It seemed peculiar that the couple are former CIA agents. Perhaps government watches their former employees' purchases more closely. Quote, with little or no evidence of any illegal activity, law enforcement officers make the assumption that shoppers at the store are potential marijuana growers, even though the stores are most commonly frequented by backyard gardeners who grow organically or start seedlings indoors, the lawsuit says. Here's a story in The Guardian by Nicholas Blinko. Electrosensitivity is technology killing us. And the story is about a man named Tim Hallam. He's 36. And he has put up foil beneath the wallpaper and under his floor, insulated his bedding to keep out low-frequency radiation and high-frequency. The article says, Tim is trying to escape atmospheric man-made radiation caused by Wi-Fi phone signals, radio, even TV screens and fluorescent bulbs. It's a hopeless task, he admits. Quote, it's so hard to get away from and it's taken a toll on my life. The author of this article says he offers to put his phone outside the room during the interview. And Tim says, yeah, do that. And he closes the door. And then Tim explains that the phone would have kept searching for a signal. And because it wouldn't find one, it would keep ramping it up. And so with tin foil inside the room, the signal would hurtle around the room like a panicked bird, essentially. This is how it's written. Tim estimates he spent $1,000 on the insulation, taking photographs at every stage to share with others with a society of particular people who suffer from electrosensitivity in the UK. He found the whole process stressful, especially after a summer sleeping in the garden of his shared house in Leamington Spa to escape a new roommate's powerful Wi-Fi router. How did he feel about his roommate at the time? Oh, I hated him. It wasn't really him, of course, but I was so angry. Among the symptoms Tim experiences, I guess this is really important here, headaches, muscular pain, dry eyes, memory lapses, and irritability. He now says his bed is the single most important thing he owns. He goes, I climb in and zip it up so I'm completely sealed. Inside, I sleep extremely well. Without it, my sleep is fragmented, and without sleep, then lots of other things go wrong. Our environment is saturated with microwave radiation that causes negative health effects. The issue of electromagnetic sensitivity is immediately political. It places sufferers on the other side from both industry and the governments that profit from leasing wavelengths. Over and over I hear the phrase, quote, we are canaries in the coal mine. Sufferers believe we are approaching a tipping point. Tim Hallam worries about the effects of electromagnetic fields on the most vulnerable, for example, his sister's young family, on children in schools bathed in Wi-Fi rays, or old people in sheltered accommodation, each with their own internet router. Quote, I think it's affecting everyone's cells. Well, listeners, this is a topic we've covered in depth in the past. We've had Amy Worthington on to discuss this. We've had Dr. Perlin Jerry on the show to discuss this in depth. People are figuring out why they're feeling so uncomfortable, this is one of the reasons. It's because of the buildup of electromagnetic fields around us. These companies are profiting from this while you're getting more and more sick. Here's another story. Horror in Israel. 30,000 Mossad spies exposed. By Gordon Duff. Last week, the hacker organization Anonymous, symbolized by the famous Guy Fawkes mask, hacked Israel's Mossad. The hack, initially exposing a hidden network of 30,000 covert operatives, some openly labeled hitmen, came only days after Israel admitted to their 2010 act of piracy and terrorism against the Freedom Flotilla. Now the Israeli regime has filled the internet with threats against Anonymous if detailed information on their terror cells is leaked. After all, who is better to carry out acts of terrorism than an organization with 30,000 covert operatives around the world, almost all trained in the use of explosives, demolition, building IEDs, car bombs, kidnapping, and assassination, and with a long and very public history of not just murdering people, but getting away with it as well. Every day we see it in the news. Dozens killed in Pakistan, dozens more in Iraq, Kenya, Nigeria. The covert army of 30,000 planning terror, building a dozen car bombs a day, then being able to not just write the lies blaming others, but in most cases, direct public officials, controlled through blackmail, threats, or bribery to respond as directed. The article continues, "The army, more correctly, the cells exposed by Anonymous include, number one, direct action, assassins, explosive experts for the Mossad signature car bombs and kidnap rendition teams. Number two, espionage, made up of trained agent handlers and signals intelligence personnel, often specially trained while posing as doing their, quote, national service. This group runs the Pentagon and White House, makes up congressional employees, most think tanks, AIPAC, and the ADL. Key espionage operatives are seldom Israeli. Many are Turkish, Saudi, Jordanian, and even Cuban diplomats. Controlled opposition, number three. Most obvious are the white supremacist, neo-Nazi groups recently exposed as being funded through Merkel's government in Germany at the direction of the Likudist Party in Israel. Nearly every individual or organization, with few exceptions, that describes itself as, quote, Holocaust denial, anti-Zionist, or historical revisionist, is now funded and directed through Israel. Number four, thought control. No textbook, no university chair, no broadcast executive, nor any news editor is ever employed unless a member of the 30,000. All belong, all are not just answerable, but actively involved in creating cover stories to shift blame for mass killings, political assassination, economic crimes, or simply to put forth a continual, quote, drumming of the big lie. The article continues. Here's another story that connects to this. Ex-CNN reporter, I received orders to manipulate news to demonize Syria and Iran. Ex-CNN reporter Amber Lyon revealed that during her work for the channel, she received orders to send false news and exclude some others which the U.S. administration didn't favor, with the aim to create a public opinion in favor of launching an aggression on Iran and Syria. Lyon was quoted by the Slovak main news website as saying that the mainstream U.S. media outlets intentionally work to create a propaganda against Iran to garner public opinion support for a military invasion against it. She revealed that the scenario used before launching the war in Iraq is being prepared to be repeated, where Iran and Syria are now being subject to constant demonization. The former reporter clarified that the CNN channel manipulates and fabricates news and follows selectiveness when broadcasting news, stressing that the channel receives money from the U.S. government and other countries' governments in exchange for news content. So connect that back to Anonymous hacking into the 30,000 Mossad agents. What did they say in this article? Here it is. No broadcast executive nor any news editor is ever employed unless a member of the 30,000. I got a couple really great emails from listeners who wanted to comment on last week's show with Dr. Judy Wood. And in that show, we discussed the idea of free energy being available to humanity. We really advanced the dialogue with Dr. Judy Wood. One of the emails from a regular listener, he writes, "I listened to Dr. Judy Wood last night. In my opinion, it seemed that her early talks relied heavily on discussion of the laws of physics and physical properties of metals and building materials. I suppose that any thesis must first rely on science and hard data to prove its worth. If Dr. Wood had just started speaking about directed energy weapons without any scientific proof, she would have been dismissed very early on and soon forgotten. Now that she has a huge body of work and research to back up her claims, she has the opportunity to speculate how society and human life would be changed if free energy was released. Quote, to know what you know that you know seems to be an invitation to discover our inner knowledge, to stop mindlessly repeating media propaganda and live as free but responsible humans on this planet. To act with personal responsibility is really a huge step. To stop making decisions that are really just following mindless propaganda, what the government tells us, what the media tells us, what religion tells us, jealousy of neighbors or coworkers, decisions based on greed or personal power over others. She is absolutely correct. If hidden technologies can now be released, then this planet will experience a huge change. In the present system, if greed and lust for power are experienced in one geographic area, then it must be true that poverty and slavery are experienced in another region to balance the rules of the commerce system. It is never discussed in the mainstream media that there is abundance for all on the planet. All that is needed for this to happen is to have truly free exchange of energy and ideas, the end of repression of truth, and the end of the energy slavery systems." Thank you, Wayne. That's one of the listeners of the show that often writes in. Appreciate that feedback. Here's another great email from last week's show. "Great show with Dr. Wood. I agree with her that if free energy technology would ever make it out to the general public, it would be the greatest scientific breakthrough of all time. But of course, we all know that there are the most powerful forces lined up to prevent that from happening. While it's presently impossible to get this technology into the general public, I think if more and more individuals were to develop it, it would become a reality that can no longer be denied. Some truths just seem to be too radical to take to the marketplace. But it should never stop the individual truth seeker from trying to discover what's possible. That's why it would be great to have a forum to discuss the latest ideas in free energy. And Dr. Wood would be a perfect individual to begin the discussion. They can keep a product out of the marketplace, but they can't stop people from thinking and talking about it." Thank you very much for that feedback. I really appreciate it. If you've been listening to the show in the last year, you may remember past guests such as Stuart Wilde and his book, Silent Power, that provided a stepping stone to better boundaries. Before that, Dr. Konstantin Korotkov had told us that human intention can be scientifically measured within the universal element of water. Any intention will have a profound effect on your mind and body. Past guest Penny Pierce, author of Frequency, dove into the topic of using your intuition and instincts. These interviews give us a background to examine the components of a wider system put together by returning guest Dr. Paul Dobransky. This week, we continue the discussion with Dr. Paul into a specific aspect of MindOS. We look specifically at turning off the autopilot and consciously using something called observing ego. What is it, and why is it important when instituting healthy boundaries? Dr. Paul Dobransky is a psychiatrist, author, speaker, and runs several websites. He joins us again today. Dr. Paul Dobransky, welcome back to In Other News.
Thank you. Good to be back.
We could just talk endlessly about what you've put together, the unifying field principle of MindOS. But can you remind listeners what MindOS is and what you've created here?
Well, MindOS stands for the operating system of the human mind. It's looking at the mind as modular in the way that the evolutionary psychologists do, that there are discrete functions in the mind, and they interact with each other in some ways the way a computer does. So for a computer to work, there has to be a kind of language or logic to what's going on. And certainly the same is true of our minds. In fact, the branch of philosophy that predates the onset of psychology with Sigmund Freud, the turn of last century and all that, were the linguists, the linguist philosophers. So they were looking at language as a model for how the human mind works. So thus far, you know, the past 110 years, 120 years that we have had psychology, there's been a huge focus, of course, on language and on talk therapy, the talking cure. But what we've done with MindOS is to make it visual, to take psychology and try to depict it through diagrams, algorithms, tree branches, where you can branch off in various directions with the functioning of the mind. And the mind is a different thing from the brain, okay? If you were a computer, then your brain would be your hard drive and your hardware, the actual electronics of the computer. But if you were a computer, your mind would be something other than the physical electronics. It would be the program that's running on the hardware. In other words, the software. So I like to think of the human mind as, you know, rich and complex and full of emotion and instincts and all these other things. But structurally, a way to look at it, it's pretty useful to look at it as a kind of software in a way. And that's what we do with MindOS. It's a way of really understanding the mind and how it operates psychologically in everyday person terms, not really complex terms and phrases, in a way that's practical for everyday living, and visual, where you can actually look at diagrams that explain what's going on.
And listeners may recall that the MindOS was also a premium for the past fundraiser. A lot of listeners had gotten the MindOS ebook and the downloaded from the link, the streaming video of MindOS, which is about 8 hours. But we're going to talk a little bit more about the MindOS in the context of observing ego. And why did you want to do that, Dr. Paul?
Well, the reason that popped up for me is I recall in the lecture and the talk that we did, we didn't really stress observing ego a whole lot. We focused down a lot on boundaries. Both boundaries and observing ego are features of what you would call your conscious mind or your higher brain, the way the evolutionary psychologists talk about it. And if it were located in the brain itself, it would be in the cerebral cortex. But it occurred to me that, you know, boundaries are very compelling, and, you know, one of the deepest needs of society today, psychologically. They're behind, you know, all conflicts on a big scale. They're behind all wars. They're behind all bullying. They're behind all crime. Boundaries, bad boundaries, are behind all these societal ills. But something has to happen before anyone can learn anything about boundaries or about psychology. And it's the first skill that I teach in any seminar at menspsychology.com or womenshappiness.com. We separate these two ways of helping men and women separately because they kind of use their own instinctual language to really understand things. But the very first skill we teach at both of those sites is observing ego. Because without it, you can't learn anything. You can't change or grow. It's that important of a prime core personal growth skill. It's the first skill anyone has to learn. And it's something very strongly encouraged by all the traditional things that are surrounding talk therapy. You know, if you recall the psychoanalysts and Sigmund Freud and all that, he had a couch. And even today, they often have a couch for you to lay on. And what that does is it kind of gets all the immediate environmental stimuli out of the way so that you can kind of really get in touch with your own mind without distraction. So there's a lot about that that encourages observing ego. It's another reason that You can't do talk therapy walking around in a park, per se. There are too many distractions, and it's unprofessional. The reason it's done in a room, in a therapy room, is to minimize distraction and set up the environment for you to really get in touch with yourself. So there's something about this observing ego as a skill that's like getting in touch with yourself. Now, everyday person terminology for what it is are words like mindfulness, the artificial intelligence. People would call it sentience or being sentient. Buddhists would call it mindfulness. It's being present-minded. It's being awake and aware and paying attention to really two things simultaneously. Paying attention to what's going on inside yourself, and at the same time, paying attention to what's going on around you in the environment. And when you have it turned on, it's like a light switch. You know, it's either on or off. And if you turn it on, it's sort of like flying a plane and shutting off the autopilot so that you can fly the plane yourself. You're at the steering wheel of your life. And you're poised to make decisions. You're in a position to be at the steering wheel of your life, fully informed about how you feel, what you're thinking, what's good for you and bad for you, and what's good for the environment and bad for the environment around you. And by environment, I don't necessarily mean physical environment. I mean the social environment, the people that you're interacting with, town and city and place you're at, and what it needs from you for things to go well between you and it.
Oh, this is really fascinating, and I can see now why it's as important as the concept of personal boundaries itself, because this is the area that's making the decision of opening the door for the exchange or the deals to come through.
Yeah, absolutely, and without it, there's no possibility of changing or growing or evolving. You can't learn if it's not turned on. And it's so useful that you can actually use it as a kind of a screen for looking at any kind of problem people are having psychologically. For example, if we were to look at an actual clinical condition like attention deficit disorder, well, being able to pay attention is a definite part of observing ego. If you can't pay attention to how you feel, what you're doing, and what's going on around you, how can you possibly learn? How can you learn social lessons? How can you learn boundaries? How can you plan your life? How can you make friendships? How could you find love or do a career? You can't do any of those things effectively if you're not at the steering wheel of your life, if you're not paying attention. So you see how a biological condition like attention deficit disorder, and it most certainly is biological and can be medicated. I know that's a different issue for us to talk about. But without the attention ability, you can't use this most basic core skill of personal growth. So it's no wonder why in a lot of clinical studies, they'll find that folks that have attention deficit disorder can sometimes run into problems with having a lot of social lessons to learn, to be able to behave in a way that suits the environment they're in, or making good and wise decisions. A lot of times folks with that disorder are known to have, quote, unrealized potential, meaning they know they're smart. Other people can tell they're smart, but why do they not have much to show for all those smarts as they go through their life? Part of the reason is they had trouble learning lessons from their life's experience. It all goes back to observing ego on that particular matter. And that's just one condition that you can use this to look at. There are at least four or five ways of tapping into this in a practical way. It's the only technical phrase that I tend to use in a layman's kind of way when I do seminars or talk to people or educate them. And the reason I use it is because, the psychiatrists and psychologists who use this phrase know that it means far more than just paying attention. It means far more than just being mindful. It means a whole lot of things all in one. It means the ability to not be on autopilot in your life, to not be mindless, or running on instinct alone. It means you're conscious, awake, and aware. So when you hear self-help authors and gurus and, you know, spiritual motivational speakers talk about motivating people, a lot of the time you'll hear them use kind of vague terminology like, you know, get conscious or lose your ego or, you know, get in touch with yourself. And to a degree, that could be inspiring, but how practical is it? Not so practical. What's the exact how-to of cultivating this very specific skill? Well, one of the ways, since we know that it can only be accomplished by being in a present moment mindset, then simply by being aware that when you let your mind drift too much into the past and into reminiscence, or too much into the future, into daydreaming, or on the flip side, worrying, you're not accessing your observing ego. Your mind is in a different time frame. You're too deep into the past or too deep into the future. An example of another clinical condition that can be very past-oriented symptomatically is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, where intrusive memories of a tragic event in the past can invade your present moment and pull you back to the past in your memory. And so how can you grow if you're always living in the past, a tragic, difficult past? They have trouble growing because of this same issue. So essentially, finding a way to get into the present is one practical, convenient way of tapping into observing ego. So what can only be done in the present? Well, one thing is using your five senses. You can't smell something from the past or taste something from the future. You can only imagine it. To really use your senses, you are being present, moment-oriented. So really getting into your senses and noticing the distinctions between different tastes, smells, lighting, visual things, touch, textures, is one way to get yourself more present moment-oriented. It could also be one of the reasons that people need vacations and go on vacations to get away from the routine and get into their senses and appreciate their senses, being on that beach or being in the mountains or being at sea or wherever you go on vacation. You're cultivating your senses. Another way to cultivate observing ego is to make a decision. You can't decide something in the past. The past is already done, set in stone. And you can't decide something in the future. It's not here yet. So when you firmly make a decision of some kind, you're also being present moment oriented and using observing ego. When you take an action that springs from a decision, you're being present minded as well. So those are two other ways to get in touch with observing ego ability. A good general rule is that asking yourself questions will help you get present-minded and tap into observing ego.
What's an example of maybe asking yourself questions?
A lot of people discourage using the word I or saying me, me, me. But this is one example where it's very good for you to be self-centered in a way and use the words I or me. You're at a business networking meeting. You're socializing for your career. You could be talking to some important people who could benefit your career and you could benefit them. And if you're mindless and not at the steering wheel, not using observing ego, you're going to miss opportunity. And you may come across discourteous or you may come across foolish. You may come across in any kind of way where there's a bad impression made by you on important people that you could connect with. So if you could be asking yourself questions like, in your mind, silently, how am I doing right now? What do they really want? What do they need? What do I have that they need?
If you can just get your mind together, come on across from me. We'll hold hands and think of watch the sunrise, sunrise from above.
Just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Paul Dobransky about his MindOS system and specifically observing ego. But before we go into the interview, I would like to remind listeners that this station continues to need your financial support for the Emergency Transmitter Fund. Please donate to that fund. Please dial 516-620-3602 and pledge your support for the Emergency Transmitter Fund. With your help, the station is slowly recovering from its past debt. And with your help, the station will recover and move to greater independence. 516-620-3602. Many of the producers and hosts have stepped up, put together their own events. You can find out more by going to the website wbai.org. And remember, you can pledge your support by going online to give. The number 2, WBAI.org, or call 516-620-3602, and please pledge your support for this wonderful station. So let's go back to this interview with Dr. Paul Dobransky, discussing observing ego in the context of his MindOS system.
So asking questions about meeting a need, connecting with other people, finding a meeting of the minds, an alignment with others, is using observing ego. It's you being conscious, awake, and aware to opportunity and to your strengths and weaknesses, for example. Another example would be, say that you're single and in the dating pool, and you have a chance to meet a lot of different people of the opposite sex, like a speed dating event or something like this. And as you're meeting all these different people, you may notice other features of their psychology, and that's one of the things we try to teach you to rapidly learn in MindOS, is how to essentially read people's psychology and really know them pretty deeply and quickly.
Is that after you've got your own MindOS figured out?
Well, it doesn't have to be a case where you completely understand all of human psychology before you go out and use it. You could just learn one little nugget of information and see it happening right in front of your face out in the world,
like
boundaries. You know, if you learn a bit about boundaries, then you figure out, when people have poor boundaries, that leads to bad things. It leads to them letting you down. It leads to them not being able to stick to their word or make a commitment to you. It leads to drama. It leads to overwhelm. It leads to confusion when people have poor boundaries. So just focusing on one little part of psychology without having mastered it or mastered your own or even understanding yourself completely, you can still learn just by seeing it happen right in front of you when you learn some of these principles.
So you can still learn about somebody else, and as you were pointing out.
Okay. Yeah, you can still learn about somebody else, and you can slowly learn about, you know, each little part of your own psychology, one nugget at a time, if that's how you learn. But, you know, this example of being in the dating pool, so say that you're paying attention to boundaries and how they work lately in your life, and you meet quite a few people to potentially date. Some of them seem honest and forthright and seem to keep their word. They don't seem controlling or too easily controllable. Boundaries are about control, what we control from what we don't. So the people you feel comfortable around who don't give you that cloying, you know, controlling feeling, you feel pretty good about. Well, when you understand MindOS and you understand this kind of psychology in general, you can consciously, on purpose, say to yourself, I think this person has good boundaries. They don't give me this controlling feeling. And they also don't seem wishy-washy, which is also a feature of poor boundaries. So maybe they're a fit person to date, because in my dating, I eventually want a commitment. So this would be a reasonable person who's capable of commitment. Why? Because they have good boundaries, and I can tell that. But you wouldn't be able to know that if you didn't have your own observing ego turned on, awake and aware and paying attention to these things. You might get lost in how sexy they are, or how good-looking they are, or how fun they are, and not pay attention to their boundary.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good example, by the way, of observing ego and how important it is. Can someone lend you observing ego?
They can. That's part of parenting. But for adults, this kind of supervisory feedback that we get never ends. It's not just from parent to child. It's from adult to adult in the form of social pressure, in the form of the law, in the form of politics and reputation and reputation management and PR. All of these fields and areas are a way where we all can get a kind of borrowing of observing ego from the population at large or from superiors we respect or experts we respect or consultants. You know, if you go to a lawyer or you go to an accountant, it's tax season now. You know, everybody's going to H&R Block and going to their accountant and getting their taxes done. When you go to an expert like that, you're essentially borrowing their observing ego on the matter of accounting and taxes. Their attention ability to that specific area of life or skill, you may not be very good at paying attention to or working with. So in that sense, you're borrowing from them. So when your accountant calls you and says, hey, you're low on your budget this month, you got to watch it, they're lending their observing ego to you. They're calling your attention to something that you weren't paying attention to.
What a timely example, Dr. Paul.
I'm using my observing ego right now. I'm doing it right now, you know. That's an example right now in the moment. I'm using it to use that example of taxes. I did that on purpose because I'm aware of, well, what do I have to give here today? What do you need today? Well, current events, taxes, people care about that right now. So I'm trying to meet the need of the environment I'm in on purpose.
Our guest is Dr. Paul Dobranski, who has put together an incredible product called MindOS, and we're talking about one very critical component of the MindOS, and that is observing ego. In the past interviews with Dr. Paul, we've talked about boundaries, but in order for boundaries to operate correctly, you need the observing ego. Dr. Paul is describing why that's critical right now. You called me a pathological narcissist. Is that different from ego?
So you're doing that as a hypothetical.
Right, right.
Okay, all right. In a nutshell, what pathological narcissism is it's essentially like being underdeveloped psychologically. In other words, it's like being less mature than you could be. Another way of putting it would be it's like being more of a child in an adult's body, if it's severe. You know, one of the interesting things, that I've experienced in my education is long ago I had a psychiatrist instructor who was an anthropologic psychiatrist. So what he would do is he'd study world cultures and their psychology. And his part of his life's work was regarding monsters, vampires and zombies, and what is the psychology of those myths. I approached him. I said, you know, this is kind of an unusual thing for one to do with their scientific life. Why do you do that? And he said, well, you got to understand, Paul, you know, all world cultures throughout all history have always had vampires or zombies as part of their mythology. And the reason that comes up, even if cultures have no connection to each other whatsoever, they're on a remote island or something, the reason they exist is to teach the society about pathologic narcissism. So all the same features that you find in a narcissist, if it's severe enough, or a bully, you know, to use layman's language, a bully, has all the same features as a vampire or a zombie in those myths. They're kind of the walking dead. They're empty. They're lacking something. They're needy. but at the same time, they're scary. That's a bully. A scary but needy person who has poor boundaries. The idea of sucking your blood is just a symbol for draining your energy or taking away your self-esteem to make themselves feel better by way of making you feel worse. That's sucking blood or eating brains in the zombie myths. So it's kind of a, you know, wacky topic, but it's interesting psychologically because it teaches a culture about narcissism. So what does that have to do with observing ego?
Right.
Well, a narcissist or a vampire in the myth or a zombie in the myth lacks self-awareness. They just eat brains or suck blood. They don't have to think, gee, I'm a monster. Maybe there's a way of becoming human. They just do what they do. They're on autopilot, so to speak, and therefore lacking observing ego. They can't see themselves. Thus, you can't see a vampire in a mirror. It's symbolic of not being able to see yourself.
The word ego may have some negative connotations to some when it's even brought up as a word, and it might be confused with narcissism. When somebody says, oh, you know, that's an ego problem, maybe when two people don't get along, things like that, what's going on there?
Well, it's the way we use words, and it's a problem of linguistics meeting pop culture. For example, if I were to say to you, hey, Jeff, we need to talk. It's kind of a friendly emotion to it. Well, it's a friendly gesture. But if I say, Jeff, we need to talk, well, that's a more serious and negative emotional connotation.
Right. So
the way we use words can be very imperfect and imprecise and is up to interpretation in all kinds of wild and crazy ways. So if you go back to the days of Freud, there are all kinds of things that Freud and then his successors interpreted, developed, theorized, and then brought into our cultures. And in pop culture, a lot of these words get twisted and turned around, and they don't mean the same thing anymore when they come into the popular lexicon. So one example, along with ego and what does ego mean, another example is a libido. Freud has a bad name for talking too much about sex and why is everything sexual and blah, blah, blah. It's a misinterpretation of his original theoretical intent. When he talked about libido, he wasn't talking just about sex drive. You know, today we think libido just means sex drive. It didn't at all mean just that to him. Libido to him was life force. In other words, a feeling of being vital and alive with vitality, which for men, I suspect, is simply being masculine, and for women is being feminine. But that's not just about sex or the sex act. It's about life force. It's about feeling vital and alive. So you see how the word got twisted into something that was not meant originally. Same is true of ego.
Mm-hmm.
So to Freud and to the psychoanalysts, our ego is overwhelmingly positive and good and simply means our ability to use our conscious mind in hopefully a sophisticated, mature way, to do our taxes accurately, to make calculations, plan, to think abstractly and imagine a future and strategize for it, to be able to dress in the morning, to do all the conscious functions of being human is what ego does for us. To the neuroscientists, you might call it executive function, conscious ability to do things and think in an advanced, abstract way, as only humans can do to our degree. So ego is overwhelmingly good. But the word egotism came into the popular lexicon because the root phrase ego in Latin means I or me. So the psychoanalytic use of the word got twisted. It mixed up with, you know, the meaning of the root, which is I. So it turned into being a self-centered person. So when you hear spiritual gurus and pop culture icons like Deepak Chopra or any of the spiritual gurus talk about ego, when they talk about it, they're not meaning ego in the Freudian sense. They're meaning stop being a jerk or stop being self-centered or selfish. So it turned the word into the opposite of what it really means. It turned it into being childish or boundaryless or selfish, egotistical, different from ego in the phrase observing ego. Observing ego is a gift of maturity that lets you see yourself as you really are, see others as they really are, and try to meet in the middle, get something good done.
There's always a potential, right? Regardless of what each person has, for two people to meet with healthy boundaries and observing ego, to exchange and have a positive outcome. There's always that possibility.
Yes. Yes, and for that reason, there are two extremely practical pop culture words that we all want to be, and observing ego is the exclusive source of these two. One is we want to be without regret. We want to have a life with no regrets. The only way to have no regrets is to have good observing ego ability. Here's an example of how. If you follow a great sports team or you love the underdog, I got into the Giants, when they won the Super Bowl and the playoffs were going on. I haven't watched a football team since I was a child and paid attention to the Pittsburgh Steelers back then. But I got into the Giants more recently, and what happened for me was, you really want your team to win, and you notice how if a team loses a game and they get interviewed, they'll say, so what happened? And they'll say, we just didn't want it enough. We weren't prepared. We didn't work hard enough. We didn't want it enough. And so they feel regret. You feel regret when you didn't try hard enough. You didn't pay attention enough. It was a foolish mistake. But when you see a team interviewed that, say, lost the Super Bowl, and they get interviewed, a lot of the time you'll see them say, we did our best. No regrets. We lost this time, but we'll try again next year. No regrets.
Right, you do hear that.
Okay, and that team lost also. What's the difference between these two teams, the one with regret versus the one without regret? The difference is the one without regret used their observing ego to the max. They watched the last season's games. They learned their enemy. They learned their strengths and weaknesses. They worked on their own weaknesses. They watched the replays. They paid attention and used observing ego to do their best, to pay attention to what's going on around them and to their own strengths and weaknesses. So when you use observing ego, you don't have regrets. No matter what happens in life, you really have done your best. So that's one example of a practical use. The only way to not have regrets is to have observing ego. The thing it's useful for, that we all want to be, the phrase used to be, or the term used to be, being cool or being a cool person. Women like cool men. Men like cool women if you're single. If you're married, you have a cool wife or you have a cool husband. The term gets changed every decade and every generation. Maybe today it's rad, or to the Britons, that's brilliant. Whatever the word is for being a cool person, the exclusive source of that is a person who has observing ego. Because notice, we can think somebody who's tall, short, fat, skinny, good-looking or ugly, doesn't matter what they are, what their physical attributes are, where they come from, rich or poor, they can still be cool in our view. Well, what makes them cool? It's that they have observing ego ability. It's that, in other words, they know the right thing to say or do in the right way at the right time. That's cool.
Because they worked on it, or they're naturally good at it.
Well, even if they didn't work on it or practice it, even if they aren't naturally good at something, just the fact that they were a good listener, paid attention, heard what you said, tried to meet your need with a self-knowledge of what they have to offer, that still made them cool. Even if they're a novice or they're young or they're inexperienced, they could still be cool because they're using observing ego.
Dr. Paul, the other aspect that you mentioned early in the interview about intuition, how it is one component of the bigger picture of MindOS. We've talked about intuition and relying on intuitive feelings on the show, and they're not New Age gurus or people who have paid attention to this, but it is one component of the bigger picture that you're describing. And could you tell listeners where intuition fits into this?
Yeah, sure. Intuition is one of those words that kind of gets changed in the popular lexicon. It's a real psychological feature of us. It's not just woo-woo spiritual guru stuff. There's even I saw on the Science Channel last night, there's a psychologist at Columbia that studies it and is doing some really great valid research about the idea of a sixth sense, of a kind of knowing before something happens. Author Malcolm Gladwell writes very profoundly about intuition as well in his book called Blink. So it's a real thing. In our model, in the MindOS, we see intuition as a kind of shrewdness or knowing that comes with experience of numerous environments and feeds your decision-making. In other words, there are two feeders of every decision you make. One, we all know well, and that's your ethics, your conscience. Decades ago, they called it your Jiminy Cricket on your shoulder. Being your own advisor, doing the right thing ethically with morality. Okay, so we're all aware of that. And Freud's word for that was superego, having a sense of guilt, doing right, not wrong. But the other thing that guides our decisions, if decisions go bad for an ethical person, I started wondering, well, why does that happen? Why do bad things happen to good people? Well, it's because there's a second feeder of wise decisions, and that's our intuition, which is the same as shrewdness or worldly wisdom or having been around the block, having tried out a difficult task in numerous kinds of environments, like being a winning football team. You have to really take a lot of knocks. You have to have a lot of experiences that teach you a kind of knowing. Even before something bad's about to happen, you just know past experience. And we could call that intuition. It's a real kind of learning that can only happen through doing. It's hands-on learning. Okay?
Yep.
So our ethics plus our intuition lead to wise decisions where things work out for us.
Did you get any feedback from the listeners of WBAI in the last fundraiser when we used MindOS as a premium?
I think they're kind of shy. our sites are very high-tech, so they're very much for folks that are into, they're glued to their computers, or their smartphones. We have an Apple app and things like that for us to be able to talk to each other and work on things together. So, it's not for folks that don't like the high tech so much. But usually the way things play out is, if somebody gets an ebook or a program on video, they'll look at it once in its entirety and then sort of go on living their life. And then about 6 months, a year later, 2 years later, then they'll come back to me and they'll say, hey, I've been through a breakup now, or I changed jobs, or I've moved. And now they have a whole bunch of new life's experience to analyze through this lens. And then they want to talk to me. So I'm not surprised if not a lot of people write us immediately right off the bat. You kind of have to let this material sink in, and then you go live your life. And what's really cool about it is some of the principles you learn, little nuggets of information, little tips, you'll see happening right in front of your face as you go live your life, and it'll strike you with observing ego, as being, wow, that's that boundary thing I learned. It's happening right now. Now I can do something about this. I know what to do. Or, oh, that person can't commit. Or that person's not very good at, you know, appealing to male masculine identity. Or that person's not good at making a woman feel feminine. You'll be able to see it right in front of your face and not just sense that something's wrong or right. You'll know why it's right or wrong.
Well, Dr. Paul, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show to discuss the many areas of MindOS and your other work as well. Thank you so much again for being on In Other News.
Oh, well, thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, Monday night, 10 p.m.